I'm GPB Savannah Station Manager Cindy Hill, and in the studio with me today is Jay Brandis, Professor of Chemical Oceanography for the University of Georgia's Skidaway Institute of Oceanography. Welcome, Jay.
Thank you.
Tell me, how did you get into chemical oceanography?
I guess you can blame it all on Jacques Cousteau. I don't know if you're of a generation that remembers Jacques Cousteau, but I grew up with his show on TV back when we only had a few channels. And I became fascinated with the ocean and decided, I was probably 6 years old when I decided that I wanted to be a marine scientist. I didn't really understand what it was, but it looked so cool. And I loved going to the beach. But as I got older, I sort of had this idea fixed in my head that this is what I wanted to do. And I grew up in Northern California, and there happened to be a small university, Humboldt State University. It's not about the same size as Armstrong, maybe a little smaller even. And they happened to have an oceanography program. And so those things meshed, and I went there specifically to learn to be a oceanographer. I didn't know, however, what kind of oceanographer I was going to be. And traditionally in oceanography, you have it divided up into sort of these major disciplines, chemistry, physics, geology, and biology. And as part of getting your degree, you had to take classes in the fundamentals of each of those four subdisciplines. And it turned out that I liked chemistry the best, and it turned out that I was actually reasonably good at it. So that was the direction I headed in. I was still doing marine science, but I was doing the chemistry of the oceans rather than studying organisms or how waves work or sediments and things like that. And as I've progressed through the field, that's been sort of my central underpinning, has been learning about the chemistry of the oceans. The laboratory I went to in Washington, D.C., I met up with a scientist there by the name of George Cody, who was involved in this really fascinating work using X-ray microscopes, which are basically a microscope like you would have in your, in science lab or whatever, except that these use X-rays instead of visible light. And I like to think about them as being sort of like Superman's eyes. And you can look at things using Superman's vision, essentially. And they're able to do things like look inside a cell and tell you what's inside it and what it's made out of. They can look at incredibly small structures in the environment. This was a fascinating area for me. So I did a lot of this for my, for this sort of postdoctoral training period. And then eventually went to the University of Texas, where I did more work in stable isotopes and more work in this X-ray field. One of the things that bears direct interest in what we're going to talk about today is that while I was looking at things through Superman's eyes, through these X-ray microscopes, some of the things that I observed were very strange. They were not what I would call normal organic matter. If you look at sediments, if you look at soils, you look at leaves, even if you look at living creatures and bacteria and so on through the X-ray microscope, you can identify these things. So you can look at standards and then compare them to what you're seeing in your samples. I was seeing these very strange looking way they were interacting with X-rays materials. And I started asking around at the place where I was doing this work, "What do you have any idea what this is?" And they looked at it and they said, "Well, I've kind of seen stuff like that from the people that are polymer chemists, people that make plastics." And lo and behold, these people had done extensive work using these instruments because they're interested in how polymers are structured at very fine scales. They want to be able to determine their properties and how they respond to stress and things like that. And the X-ray microscope is a very good tool to look at these kind of things. And so they had developed a library, basically, of lots of different compounds, lots of different plastics, so that you could go through and say, okay, yeah, that's, Delrin, or this is Teflon, or this is some other type of plastic from the way it looked under the microscope. And lo and behold, these weird things that I was seeing were plastic. They were Teflon. They were polypropylene and things like that, but very, very tiny pieces of plastic. And these are out in places like the Gulf of Mexico or the North Sea. I mean, not in your backyard, not at Tybee Beach or whatever. These are places that were far away from the coastline. So this got me very interested in this particular question of where are these things coming from and what's happening to them.
What is microplastics? We've heard this word. It's kind of a buzzword now.
It's an operationally defined term. Basically, when scientists have to try and categorize things, they typically want to put them in different categories, and they'll do it on basis of size. So people that have been studying plastics and the whole issue of plastic debris and trash in the oceans and things like that, you have your whole category of what we think of as just regular trash out there. And that's anything you can see with the naked eye. Things that are smaller than that, and we just sort of make that cut off at about 5 millimeters, you can still see that with your eye. But if you look at it on a beach, you're not going to easily see it unless you're really looking. Anything smaller than 5 millimeters is a microplastic.
Do we need to be thinking about that when we are on the beach and you see somebody's flip-flop wash up? Is that eventually going to break down to be a microplastic?
One of the avenues for microplastics is definitely the breakdown of larger pieces. And essentially, the field understands microplastics is coming from several different sources.
Yeah.
So, you know, all of us have probably seen a styrofoam cup break into pieces and get those little beads that you come out of it. So there's physical breakdown of the plastics into smaller and smaller pieces just from grinding against each other, grinding against sand grains and so on. There is photochemical degradation, as you probably have seen if you ever leave a plastic toy out in your backyard during the summer. In a pretty short period of time, it becomes brittle, it fades, it can break into pieces pretty easily. Boaters will see this sort of stuff happening if they don't protect their boats with paint and antioxidants and UV protectants. And then there are microplastics that are created at that size. And recently, in the last 2 years, we've had a major discussion going on, not only in this country, but worldwide, about the manufacture of something called microbeads, which are very, very small pieces of plastic that are put in cosmetics, cleansers, other types of products to add roughness, to add a scrub to the material. And there's been a lot of discussion about the production of these very, the deliberate production of these very, very small materials.
So what is the has the discussion led anywhere yet?
Yes, it has. And actually, it's been, I would say, very encouraging. Microbeads, actually, the production of these were banned in several states last year. At the beginning of this year, 2016, the U.S. Congress banned their production. And, with great speed, actually, in terms of once it was brought up, once people became aware of this issue, because people were measuring these beads in lakes and rivers and finding large numbers of them out there. And so they raised the alert about this. And at least it was gratifying to see. The production of these things is if it's not faded out next year, it'll be in the next couple of years. And manufacturers have gone along with this without a problem because they have alternatives. They have natural scrubs that they can substitute at, from what I can tell, the same kind of cost. So it doesn't cost them anything just to switch over.
Well, that's good. So you guys basically, your conversation led to a positive change that was an easy change.
Yeah, I mean, I will tell you, it's not me. This was a major effort by large groups out there.
The science, the people.
Yeah,
the science, though.
Yeah. The fact that people measured these things, because if you look at the history of marine trash, plastics, debris studies, we've known about this problem for a long time. But up until probably this century, I guess, it would be a good cutoff point, people have focused on the big stuff. Because you see it. You see seabirds with their stomachs filled with plastic or sea turtles with a ring around their neck that's constricting them. Big, obvious things. And then, the major studies that started happening about a decade ago looking at these trash areas in the oceans where the currents basically sweep everything into a center of an area called a gyre. And the efforts that have been focused on both to understand this, to quantify how much is out there, and to try to understand how it breaks down and, think about how to clean it up, which is a huge job.
is any of the science now looking at how to clean it up, or is it still just kind of quantifying and figuring out what this is? And also, what is the impact of this? I mean, it's pretty easy to imagine. You know, nobody wants dirty water. Nobody wants polluted water. But what is the impact? The impact that you guys have seen thus far of these microplastics in the ocean?
Okay. Well, let me back up a bit on that.
Yeah.
Just to tell you that about 6 years ago, I was given funds through the Georgia, basically there's a program called Georgia Incentive Grants, just to look at the trash that's on the beaches. And we basically worked with the groups that are out there cleaning up the beach trash. And, I mean, they do an incredible job. I have nothing but respect for people that give their time to do this. But the point of that particular study was to understand how much trash was washing up on our shores. And that was a 2-year study done where we reported back to the department, and we published a paper on this discussing, you know, how much trash and where it's distributed. And as you would expect, the heaviest distribution is on Tybee. Basically, wherever it goes by population, but it isn't entirely due to population, because you can go to a place like Cumberland Island or some other place that's not so heavily used, and there's still a fair amount of trash. And I think anybody that takes a boat out and goes to any of our wonderful estuary systems, if they stop in the seagrass or in the marsh grass, they will find they'll find trash everywhere. So it's a constant effort to clean that up. But once that study was done, I was thinking much more about trying to think about these microplastics. Again, getting back to my sort of previous experience looking at them through X-ray microscopes, I wondered how much microplastic was there out here in the sands and in the estuaries, and was it getting into the local organisms? So Sea Grant funded us last year to do what we think of as a kind of an exploratory study. So basically just to get an idea of, okay, is there a problem? And if there is a problem, how prevalent, you know, is the problem? We're not funded at this point to do studies of, like, does it cause organisms to be, you know, sicker or to die or whatever. It's a different study than what my colleague Mark Fisher was talking about.
Yeah, so you're answering the question of, is this a problem?
Yeah.
Yeah,
so because nobody knows. There are people in other parts of the world. There's a group up in South Carolina that are studying the prevalence of microplastics in different environments. But nobody in Georgia prior to our study was really looking at these things in any kind of detail.
What can we as non-scientists, as regular citizens, do to increase our awareness of microplastics and certainly not make the problem worse or even make it better if there are opportunities to do that?
Yeah. Well, I think first and foremost, any way that you can avoid getting plastic out in the environment, so making sure it gets put in the landfill, it gets recycled, trying to reduce your particular use of plastic, your individual use of plastics. I try to use a a bag that I use instead of those terrible plastic bags that they tend to give you tons of. Any way to reduce that, just plastics getting out into the environment, because as I noted earlier, one of the major ways that microplastics are produced is through the breakdown of bigger things. So not letting styrofoam cups get out there when you're out boating, you know, anything that reduces that input of materials into the ocean is something that each and every one of us can do. And of course, it affects the big stuff too. So, you know, it's a win for us no matter what.
How many people are studying this or answering the question of, are these microplastics affecting our coast?
Right now, I have a couple of people in my laboratory. I have a woman who is an intern. She is in between. She finished up her undergraduate degree, and now she's thinking about going to graduate school, but she wanted to spend time doing some science and kind of learning if that was what she really wanted to do with her life. So she's helping with me. One of my main collaborator in this project is Miss Dodie Sanders, who works over at Merrick, UGA's education side, over in the aquarium side of our whole facility out there at SCIO. And she has been interacting with the UGA has a monthly, bimonthly boat trawl that they go out and they collect animals. They collect fish, shrimp, anything they can get in their net. And then they count them up because it's part of their duty to sort of assess the health of the ecosystem out there. You know, what types of organisms are found at different places and how that compares with previous years. But what we've been able to do is, okay, they collect the animals, they identify them. We take those animals and we take their, basically we take them back to the laboratory and dissect them. We collect their gut contents, so their stomachs and intestines and so on. And then we take that material and subject it to some fairly harsh chemicals that are capable of destroying all of the flesh that you get from a, you know, a big mass of intestines and stuff, but leaving most plastics behind. Because the problem is that when you first dissect an, or even a small fish, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack when you're looking at these really small plastics. So you have to get rid of all that other stuff, and then we clean it up. We look at it under a microscope to identify whether there are any plastics found in their gut contents. That's been one of the big things that we've been doing with the Sea Grant funds this year.
You mentioned Merricks. Can people, humans, like, you know, lay scientists, get involved with this in any way? Is there any way we can help?
Well, you know, they have volunteers, so people can volunteer, and they've done that. We've done this for a variety of things, not just the microplastics, but also the ongoing beach plastic study to try to understand the big stuff.
Yeah.
They have a lot of teacher training workshops, and one of the most fun things I've been able to do is in interact with these teacher training workshops, take them out to a place like Tybee Beach, collect sand, bring it back and extract out the plastics from the sand and show them, hey, you thought that sand was completely pristine and clean. And, you know, from a tourist standpoint, it is. But there's still stuff in there. And we started talking about where it came from and what might, you know, effects it might have and that sort of thing.
Does the fact that we have very active ports here in Savannah and in Brunswick influence the presence of microplastics, do you think?
Ports, probably not so much. It's really it's people. It's people doing things on the coast. And we have a tendency to love things to death. And we're not obviously killing the coastline with our tourism. It's great. It's a wonderful feature. But it does create more of a influx of plastics. And I think anybody out at Tybee will tell you, after a big group of tourists has come in, there's a huge cleanup that has to be done. But the big ships, not so much. But you do get materials coming from, people that are out on boats, fishing fleets, and so on. Just simply stuff that washes overboard, or maybe people aren't as careful about it as they should be.
Okay. So basically, we can be really great advocates when we're at the beach to make sure we clean up after ourselves. If we see other people's stuff, clean up after that. Is there any website or anything like that where we can go to get more information about what we can do and what's happening with microplastics?
Well, at the moment, the Skidaway website is still in a bit of flux. So,
that's cool. Okay.
It will eventually be a good place to do that. I will tell you, in terms of marine debris, we have one of the world's experts up on main campus in Athens, Jenna Jambeck. And if you happen to go and look at her site, she's in the Department of Engineering. She is heavily involved in the study of larger scale plastics in the world environment. She is another person that has one of these apps that lets you report where you found trash, what type of trash it is, and to plot it up on a global map to kind of give an indication of the distributions of it. So at the moment, anyway, I'd point to her.
Excellent. So is that an app that anybody can download
and
use?
Yes, of course.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. So what have I not asked you that's interesting about this?
Well, you haven't asked me about what we've actually found.
Ah, and there you go. I kind of thought you were in the middle of a study, so yes.
Yeah, we are in the middle of a study.
Hey, Jay, what have you found?
That doesn't mean we have nothing to say.
Yeah, what have you found so far?
Well, you know, the thing that has been, I guess, the biggest surprise to me, you know, going into this, there's all this discussion about microplastics, microbeads, particularly these face scrub things that they've recently banned. But I think that What we found and what a lot of other people are finding is that one of the major microplastics that you find out there are microfibers. And these come from clothing. These come from sheets. They come from coats. You know, if you look at an advertisement, you'll see microfiber sheets and so on. And, you know, they're the materials that we make our clothing out of nowadays that have a lot of plastic in them. Those wash out of your clothing, and they are small. These are fibers that you typically have to look at under a microscope to see. So, you know, one of the things I think that was the biggest surprise to us was that when we started looking at organisms, when we started looking at beaches, we've looked both at, you know, beaches along the coastline, and we've been extracting these samples out of organisms, which is a slow process, as you can imagine. We're finding microfibers everywhere. And almost every small fish that we sampled, we've found a few microfibers in their guts. And they're pervasive. You basically, when you are processing these samples in the laboratory, you have to take special measure to prevent contamination from microfibers floating around in the air and getting pulled onto your little filtration apparatus where you sample these things. So they're everywhere. We don't see them. Now, having said that, the next question is, well, what sort of harm can these things do? And it's not clear if they're doing any harm at all. We are not finding the same kind of things that you see of seabirds with their stomachs packed with plastic so that they can't eat and they die of starvation. We're not finding fish with their stomachs packed with microfibers. These are pretty flexible little things, and it's hard to tell if it's causing any sort of real problems. There are theoretical reasons why they could, but we're not studying that yet. All we're doing is trying to identify what's out there. And what I would also caution people to understand is just because it has been identified that they are out there, it doesn't mean that that is a cause for concern at this point. You know, like personally, I eat shrimp, I eat local fish, I love them. The fact that they might have microfibers in their gut contents and their stomachs and so on doesn't bother me because I don't tend to eat whole fish. I tend to eat, you know, shrimp that have been deveined and so on. But even if I did, I mean, I know that I'm likely have ingested them just on my food at home because they're floating around in the air. It's almost like lint. In fact, they come out in the lint in your dryer if you end up looking at it closely. So at this point, from a scientific standpoint, it's a fascinating thing that's going on. It's a fascinating kind of experiment that mankind's playing on the environment. They're putting all these little tiny plastic fibers out into the environment, but we don't really know what the end impact is going to be for this.
Do you have any kind of idea of how long it would take to study something like that? Because I don't even know when microfibers began to be used for fabric. I don't.
Yeah, they've been around at least a couple decades. I mean, people have been using plastic and like nylon and things like that in their clothing for over 70 years. And in terms of studying their effect on organisms, there are people doing that in other places. Not so much with microfibers, although now that microfibers have become a more important and more recognized contaminant in the environment, there are people starting to do this. But that type of work takes time. You have to have organisms that are living in a healthy environment and then feed some of them microfibers and some of them not, and then you can see what type of compounds or contaminants or effects they might have on those organisms. But that takes time to put through.
Are there any other questions that this research is bringing up for you that have you really excited? Or are there any other things that you're thinking about that might be offshoots of this research into microplastics?
Well, one of the things that we're interested in, it comes back to that history term. I'm interested to know how long ago these microfibers How long ago was it that these things became pervasive in the environment? And one way to do that is to look in the sands and the sediments of our local beaches and marsh areas. So one of the things that I've been working on heavily with Dodie Sanders and with the other people in my group is to develop a method that is relatively easy to do and relatively inexpensive to separate out those microfibers from the sediments that they're found in normally. And it seems to be working pretty well. So I think one of the next major steps is going to be to start mapping out both along the surfaces, kind of like what we did with the big plastics, but now with microplastics, how pervasive they are along our coast, and then how long ago, how old in the sediment record, how far back do they go?